Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission, as always, is to take these huge stacks of source material, all the raw data of history as it happens, and really distill it down into something critical, something you can understand and maybe even use. Today, we are analyzing what might just be the most compressed, high-stakes presidential campaign in American history. It's quite something.
It really is. Our sources focus intensely on just 107 days. Think about that. It kicks off with this completely unprecedented political emergency in July.
Right.
And it doesn't really conclude until January with a constitutional duty that must have been incredibly difficult.
And this deep dive, it's really about crisis management at the highest level.
Absolutely. The source material gives us this incredibly intimate look at the transition after President Biden's, well, completely unexpected withdrawal from the 2024 race. That was July 21st.
A Sunday.
And we're charting everything from that moment. The strategic pivots, the logistical, frankly, nightmares, the foreign policy crises that just kept coming.
Because the world doesn't stop for a campaign.
Not at all. And then, of course, the final difficult conclusion of the campaign itself.
The timeline starts so dramatically. The sources, they paint this picture. The ball comes in, blocked caller ID. Only one person uses that.
Right, the president.
And Vice President Harris, she's at home in sweatpants on a quiet Sunday. And the only staff nearby, her grandnieces, apparently under 4 feet tall.
It's such a stark contrast, isn't it? This like earth-shattering political moment happening amidst total domestic normality.
Yeah, it really underscores how unprepared everyone, absolutely everyone, was for this kind of emergency.
It triggered instant political triage. There was zero flexibility. The clock was ticking, especially with state ballot deadlines just looming.
Looming very large.
Extremely large. Mm. And the sources make it clear the immediate realization was, we cannot waste a single day, not one. And that meant making some brutal strategic choices right out of the gate, particularly on policy.
And that brings us directly to your mission today, listening to this. We want you to quickly absorb the strategic thinking, the decision-making process behind this incredibly compressed campaign.
Yeah, understanding that high-stakes environment where literally every single decision, who's the running mate, how do you handle that debate attack, it was all scrutinized in real time. Intense pressure.
So let's start right there with those first hard choices, those initial hours. Focusing on the policy messaging, what gets prioritized?
Well, the sources are very clear. There was huge pressure, massive pressure, to talk about climate change.
You hear that a lot, especially from younger voters.
Exactly. The data showed one in five voters, particularly younger ones, had high levels of what they called climate anxiety. It was a major concern.
Okay, so a key voting bloc is deeply worried about this, but the campaign shelved it.
Immediately. That complex policy discussion, things like a just transition for workers, it just had to be put aside.
But hang on, isn't that a huge risk? You're potentially leaving those crucial Gen Z younger votes just on the table, as they say. Did the sources suggest any regret about that trade-off later? Did that come back to bite them?
It was definitely seen as a conscious and, a painful trade-off. It was all driven by the scarcity of time.
Just not enough days on the calendar.
Not nearly enough. The campaign's calculation was stark. Explaining complex climate policies properly takes time. It requires education, messaging, repetition.
And in a 107-day sprint.
You don't have that luxury.
Yeah.
They had to go for immediate penetration on, kitchen table issues, things that hit home right away.
So what did they choose instead?
They prioritized things they could message quickly and simply, lowering housing costs, tackling high prescription drug prices, going after price gouging, issues voters could feel or at least understand almost instantly.
That really is the definition of political triage, isn't it? Like an ER nurse deciding who gets the attention first when resources are limited. Heavy choices.
Absolutely. It's heavy, but necessary in that context. The core resource problem wasn't just money or staff. It was voter attention. It's incredibly scarce.
Yeah.
The sources even bring up that classic advertising rule. You need to hear a message at least three times before it even starts to sink in.
Right, the rule of three.
So if the campaign tried to push five major complex issues, the fear was that none of them would actually stick. They had to choose depth and simplicity over breadth and nuance. It was a gamble. Hashtag tag II. The campaign launch and political triage, July.
Let's dig a bit deeper into that triage mentality then, and this challenge of just getting information to penetrate. I mean, you're essentially building a presidential campaign's messaging from scratch in less time than most people plan a wedding.
Right. And think about the infrastructure side of it. Mm-hmm. The sources really detail the immense difficulty, the sheer complexity of transferring an entire campaign operation.
It's not just waving a wand.
Not at all. You've got the principal security detail, donor lists, staff loyalties, office leases, everything shifting from one leader to another almost overnight is a monumental task.
And speaking of infrastructure, let's talk money. Because the financial details and the sources are frankly staggering. We hear that before the sudden change, the Biden campaign was, well, it wasn't looking good.
It was looking dire.
Yeah.
They were facing, according to a senior campaign finance official, imminent financial collapse. The quote was, they weren't going to make payroll within weeks if things didn't change drastically.
Wow. So that points to some serious inertia, maybe donor fatigue setting in with the previous campaigns.
That seems to be the implication. A certain level of malaise had clearly affected the existing structure.
Yeah.
Donors weren't opening their wallets in the way they needed to.
Okay, so Biden withdraws, Harris steps up. What happens to the money then? Did that change just as quickly?
It was like flipping a switch, immediate and transformative. There's this one anecdote. An event originally planned for the Biden Victory Fund, aiming for maybe $400,000.
Suddenly, almost instantaneously after the announcement, it shoots up to over $1.5 million.
Just like that.
Just like that. And the sources say this surge wasn't just big institutional donors suddenly getting excited. It was fueled by real grassroots enthusiasm. A feeling that, okay, now there's a viable path forward.
And that cash infusion must have been absolutely critical.
Lifeblood. It allowed them to build out the staff they needed, launch that immediate advertising blitz. You can't run a national campaign on fumes.
No. And the energy shift, it wasn't just financial. It was visible at those first rallies. The sources point specifically to one in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires.
Yeah, that Pittsfield rally was really important for signaling intent, setting a tone. It was put together incredibly quickly, but they managed to get A-list talent there. James Taylor, Yo-Yo Ma.
Wow, okay, big names early on. Big names. And crucially, the signs changed. It wasn't the Biden Victory Fund anymore. It was the Harris Victory Fund. That logistical shift was visible proof the transition was real and happening fast. It leveraged that high-profile support to build legitimacy and momentum right away.
But one of the most, I guess, memorable indicators of that grassroots buzz didn't come from a political strategist. It came from social media, from a South Asian pediatrician, the Lotus for Puss meme.
Isn't that incredible? It's such a fantastic cultural nugget. So Kamala means lotus in Sanskrit.
Right.
And this meme, created by a 53-year-old pediatrician, just perfectly captured this huge, almost immediate wave of excitement and support, especially, though not exclusively, within the South Asian community.
It shows a real personal connection.
Exactly. It reflected this deep personal connection many people felt to the new person at the top of the ticket. It showed the enthusiasm wasn't just, you know, manufactured party spin. It was genuine, personalized, and spreading organically.
Okay, so the public face is energetic, money's flowing. But behind the scenes, let's talk operations. The sources stress something interesting. National politics is one thing, but the family logistics for the convention prep were, quote, just as gnarly.
Huh. Yes, that's often completely overlooked in these high-stakes situations.
Uh-oh.
It's easy to focus on the delegates and the speeches.
Sure.
But managing a large, sprawling family network for a huge event like a convention. You've got elderly relatives who need specific arrangements, cousins flying in, transportation, hotels, tickets. It's a massive undertaking.
And the sources say this often fell to the candidate's sister, Maya.
That's right. And handling all that requires immense bandwidth, a focus that, frankly, takes away from the core political work that needs doing. Family politics can be incredibly demanding.
And the convention planning itself, the actual show production, had to serve two different audiences simultaneously, right?
Exactly. You've got the committed delegates in the room. They need to feel energized, validated, hear the policy substance. The energy needs to be electric for them.
But then you've got millions watching at home.
Right. And for that broader television audience, people tuning in perhaps for the first time, the sources say the priority was different. It was about establishing competence, projecting strength, showing independence.
So how did they try to achieve that?
They focused heavily on highlighting her past work, specifically as Attorney General. The messaging emphasized her experience taking on, as the source puts it, perpetrators of all kinds.
Okay.
You know, mentioning financial fraudsters, sexual abusers, polluters. The goal was really to cement this image of a seasoned prosecutor, someone tough, someone ready for the top job on day one.
Okay, convention logistics sound intense, but even that seems dwarfed by the next deadline they faced, selecting a running mate. The sources call this an excruciatingly tight time frame.
Excruciating is probably an understatement. 11 days, just 11 days.
It's hard to even fathom vetting potential vice presidents in that time.
It really is. They had to conduct a full vetting process, background checks, interviews, deep dives into records, and then announce their pick before the Ohio ballot law deadline, August 6th.
And missing that deadline.
Catastrophic. It would have meant potentially not appearing on the ballot in a critical swing state. That's basically game over before you even start. Normally, this process takes months, not days.
And the VP role itself, it's such a strange political beast. You have John Nance Garner's famous, rather crude quote about it not being worth a bucket of warm piss.
Right, that always hangs over it.
But then you see how presidents like Carter or Reagan with Bush Sr. or Clinton with Gore, they really reshaped the office, made it substantive.
Exactly. And that was the core challenge here. The new candidate needed someone who could, theoretically, step into the presidency immediately if needed.
Job one.
But who could also accept the inherent limitations and, let's be honest, the often frustrating reality of being the number two. It's a fundamental contradiction they had to navigate.
So where did they turn for advice on navigating that?
They sought counsel from political heavyweights, people who understood that dynamic intimately. Specifically, the sources mentioned conversations with Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Interesting. What was the key advice from the Clintons?
Two main things really stood out in the source material. First, Hillary apparently advised choosing someone who brings a sort of joyful energy to the ticket. Someone naturally optimistic, someone people enjoy being around.
Okay, the vibe matters.
The vibe matters. And second, both Clintons stressed, be very aware that the public and the media can spot a purely political marriage of convenience a mile off.
Right. It has to feel authentic.
It has to feel genuine. Based on real mutual respect, not just ticking some strategic box like geography or demographic appeal. Bill also apparently emphasized finding someone who knew things I didn't know, even if their politics weren't identical. Complementary skills.
So the vetting process itself, it was done under intense secrecy, obviously. But the sources reveal this really personal filter being used, this clandestine operation called Operation VEP in a Jeep.
Yes. This wasn't just about dodging the press, though that was definitely part of it, keeping the finalists hidden.
Right.
The social secretary, a woman named Storm Horncastle, used this apparently beat-up 1999 Jeep Wrangler and later a tinted vehicle to ferry the potential VPs to secret meetings. But there was an ulterior motive.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What was the ulterior motive?
According to the source, the candidate used this as his strategic observation point. She wanted to see how these potential running mates treated Storm Horncastle.
Who they might see as just staff.
Exactly. Someone they might perceive as less powerful, a non-political embassy worker doing the driving. The source says this came directly from the candidate's own childhood memories.
How so?
Remembering watching her mother, described as a small brown woman with a foreign accent, sometimes faced derision and disrespect from people who thought she was unimportant.
Wow.
So she needed a running mate who instinctively treated everyone with dignity, regardless of their title or status. It was a character test, a pressure test, that went way beyond just policy alignment or political calculation.
That's a fascinating, almost ethical filter to apply in such a high-stakes political decision. Okay, let's look at the finalists who went through this process and the key concerns about each. Starting with Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania.
Shapiro was, on paper, a very strong contender. Poised, polished, incredibly articulate, and crucially, governor of Pennsylvania, a state with 19 electoral votes, absolutely vital.
A huge prize.
Huge. The campaign knew his political skill was top tier, but there was this nagging concern, as the sources put it.
Which was?
His ambition. Now, ambition is normal, expected in politicians. But the way it manifested during the vetting raised a red flag.
How did it come across?
Apparently, he mused about wanting to be in the room for every decision, essentially positioning himself almost as a co-president.
That could cause friction.
Exactly. The candidate had to respond very bluntly, the sources say, explaining that the VP job is simply not a co-president. The worry was that his potential frustration in the number two role would inevitably create internal conflict down the line.
Yeah, you don't need drama inside the ticket.
No. The candid assessment recorded in the sources was basically, I'll have 99 problems and my vice president can't be one. The partnership needed to feel seamless, built on trust.
Okay, so that was Shapiro. Then we have Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, who ultimately got the nod. Though the sources mentioned Pete Buttigieg was initially preferred from a longer list.
Yes, Buttigieg was apparently high on an initial list of 8, but Walz emerged as the finalist alongside Shapiro and Kelly. And Walls presented a real contrast to Shapiro.
In what way?
He was much less polished in that traditional DC sort of way, genuinely self-deprecating, maybe a bit folksier, and crucially, he had this authentic connection to rural America.
Something often lacking on Democratic tickets.
Very much so. He understood agriculture, knew about hogs and soy, was an avid hunter. That resonated, but the absolute deciding factor, according to the sources.
What was it?
His explicit lack of ambition for the top job. He apparently went into the vetting process, assuming he wouldn't get picked, and he straight up promised to do whatever I found was most useful. No ego about the role.
Loyalty and compatibility over polish.
That seems to be the calculation. Loyalty, compatibility, and the explicit promise that he would always have her back. That sealed it, even though there was some initial internal pushback. The sources mention Doug Emhoff initially leaned towards Shapiro's polish.
Interesting. And the final finalist, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, an astronaut, a very magnetic figure, represents that ideal of selfless service. What was the apprehension there?
The concern with Kelly wasn't about character or capability in the traditional sense. It was about political fortitude, specifically his experience with brutal personal political attacks.
He hadn't really been through the ringer.
Not in the same way. He hadn't had that truly defining, oh shit, moment, as the sources describe it, where your reputation is systematically attacked, often unfairly.
Like the swift boating of John Kerry?
Precisely. The campaign constantly had that 2004 example in mind, how a genuine war hero was effectively smeared by false claims. The worry was that Trump's campaign would inevitably go after Kelly personally, try to demean him, and they weren't sure how he'd cope with that sheer ugliness, that political grinder, without getting knocked off message.
And in a 107-day race, you can't afford that risk.
No time to test that kind of resilience under fire. They needed someone they were confident could take the hits and keep moving forward without faltering. Hashtag Take 3, Foreign Policy and Geopolitical Challenges.
Okay, so the VP pick is made under immense pressure, but the campaign couldn't just focus inward. Global crises kept erupting. The source material gives us a really deep look into the foreign policy pressure cooker, especially the ongoing Israel-Gaza dilemma. That put the campaign in a really tough spot strategically, didn't it?
Oh, it was arguably the most complex, most volatile issue they faced. On one hand, the candidate held this fundamental belief in Israel's right to respond to the horrific October 7th attacks. It was non-negotiable. But the sources reveal this deep, growing concern that Prime Minister Netanyahu's approach, the sheer ferocity of the response, as they put it, and the resulting humanitarian crisis, the denial of adequate food and medical supplies to innocent Gazans, was seriously eroding Israel's moral standing globally.
So that creates this major strategic tension, right? How do you maintain strong support for a key ally, which is expected, while also distinguishing yourself from the outgoing administration, which was facing increasing criticism, especially from younger voters and the left, over its handling of that humanitarian crisis?
That tension basically defined their entire diplomatic effort during those 107 days. It was a constant balancing act.
The sources detail a specific meeting with Netanyahu. How did that go?
Expectations were described as low going in, and apparently that was accurate. Netanyahu's demeanor was reportedly disengaged, sort of a hooded gaze, and he flatly refused to acknowledge the scale of the starvation happening in Gaza.
Blaming Hamas.
Blaming Hamas for looting food aid, denying the reality on the ground. And his position on a ceasefire was very clear. He only wanted a temporary pause, mainly to secure hostage releases.
Not an end to the conflict.
No. The assessment was he believed he could just run out the clock, wait until after the U.S. election, hoping for a potentially more sympathetic administration, meaning Trump, to take power.
So given that reality, what was the stated goal for the U.S. position during this period? What were they pushing for?
It was consistently two-pronged, according to the sources. First, maintain robust, unwavering support for Israel's security needs. But second, simultaneously push extremely hard for a permanent ceasefire agreement and, crucially, a viable day after plan.
A plan for what comes next in Gaza.
Exactly. Something that offered Palestinians some kind of tangible political horizon, a path towards stability and self-governance. The feeling was, without that political track, the cycle of violence would just inevitably repeat.
Interestingly, the sources even include a critique, maybe an implicit one, of President Biden's public handling of the humanitarian side of this.
Yes. It's noted that the perceived failing, or perhaps the challenge, was one of emotional balance in public messaging.
How so?
While President Biden was known as a staunch, lifelong Zionist and could express incredibly passionate empathy for Israelis and also for Ukrainians,
right,
his public remarks about the suffering of innocent Gazan civilians often came across according to the source material, as inadequate and forced, sort of tacked on.
And that created a political vulnerability.
It did. That perceived imbalance, that failure to consistently project empathy for Palestinian civilians alongside strong support for Israel, created a domestic political opening, a vulnerability that the new ticket had to address very quickly and carefully in their own messaging.
Okay, shifting from that crisis to a major diplomatic win that happened during this period, the sources detail this massive, complex prisoner exchange on August 1st.
Yeah, this is a huge deal, a six-country exchange, really Cold War-era scale stuff. It secured the release of Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich and former Marine Paul Whelan, plus 14 other political prisoners held in various countries.
A significant achievement.
Hugely significant. And vital, not just for freeing those individuals, but also politically. It served as a powerful demonstration that the painstaking, often quiet diplomatic work the Biden administration had been doing for years.
Mending relationships after the previous administration?
Precisely. Mending those frayed international relationships was actually tongue off. It showcased effective governance, competence, the ability to make complex international deals work right at a critical moment in the campaign.
And the sources even detail the return itself, including a moment of very human awkwardness.
Yeah, it sounds like it was just emotional chaos on the tarmac. Paul Whelan, who'd been locked up the longest, understandably rushed straight into his family's arms.
Of course.
And apparently, President Biden got quite involved in that emotional family reunion, so much so that he didn't immediately notice Evan Gershkovich stepping off the plane.
So Evan was just there.
Standing awkwardly at the bottom of the stairs, alone for a beat. And the vice president noticed this, saw him standing there. And, according to the source, quickly broke away from the main group, walked over to Evan with her arms outstretched.
A personal touch.
A small, but really important personal intervention. Providing immediate recognition, a moment of calm and welcome for a young man who must have been incredibly disoriented after everything he'd been through.
These campaigns, though, they don't exist in a bubble. Foreign policy keeps moving. The national security team, they had to stay constantly engaged, right? Situation room briefings throughout these 107 days.
Absolutely. The threat level didn't pause for the election. The sources specifically mention the ongoing tension, like the coordinated defense efforts back in April when Iran launched over 100 ballistic missiles towards Israel.
A major escalation.
Huge. And the sheer logistical and diplomatic effort required behind the scenes to coordinate the response with allies, to successfully intercept most of those missiles that prevented the situation from spiraling into an uncontrollable regional war. It just underscores the deep institutional capacity needed to manage global crises, regardless of who's out on the campaign trail shaking hands. Hashtag tagaphoria, media battles, debates, and political attacks.
Okay, let's pivot to the ultimate political crucible. The debate stage. The preparation for that critical showdown against Donald Trump sounds like it was incredibly intense.
Oh, massively intense. They even relocated the prep sessions. Instead of doing them at the vice president's official residence, they moved everything to a custom-built mock set in the basement of Howard University.
Howard, her alma mater. That feels symbolic.
Highly symbolic. A return to her roots, maybe a grounding location. And the overall strategy for the debate, it wasn't necessarily about proving she was the biggest wonk on every single policy detail.
What was the goal then?
The goal was more fundamental. Leave voters feeling comfortable. Comfortable that she possessed the necessary demeanor, the fortitude, the command, the presence to be president.
Projecting readiness.
Exactly. And the internal mantra the team apparently kept repeating was simple, almost counterintuitive for a debate. The person who is winning is the person who is having the most fun. Trying to project calm confidence, not just defensiveness.
Okay, so demeanor was crucial. But what about the actual strategy for engaging Trump directly? He's obviously a unique opponent.
The plan was to be on offense continually, not just reacting, but driving the agenda. But they also knew they had to be strategically prepared for absolutely anything, especially personal attacks.
Expecting the worst.
Totally. The debate book they put together was apparently enormous, covering every conceivable policy nuance and potential attack line. They eventually distilled it down to a thick stack of color-coded index cards. They rehearsed relentlessly for the ugly grinder, as they called it, of baseless personal assaults.
The sources even mentioned preparing for some really dark hypothetical personal attacks, right?
Yes. They specifically game-planned for a potential question directly about her own abortion history or reproductive choices.
Wow. How did they prep for that?
the standard planned response was something like, "That's frankly none of your business, and that's not why we're here tonight," keeping professional boundary setting.
Right.
But the source notes, during one particularly intense late-night prep session, someone made this incredibly dark joke, maybe half-joking, that if Trump actually went that personal, she should just fire back by asking if he took Viagra or if he'd ever paid for an abortion.
I grieve.
It just illustrates the gutter level of personal degradation they felt they had to steel themselves for, the kind of politics they expected to face.
So the debate itself, September 10th. The sources say Trump came out swinging immediately, launching into lies.
Right off the bat. He immediately started lying about immigrants stealing black jobs, which, the source notes, the candidate internally found just ludicrous given she was standing right there on stage, a black woman holding the quote-unquote black job of vice president.
How did she counter that specific point?
Her counterpunch was pretty effective. She pivoted quickly to the recently failed bipartisan border bill, pointing out that Trump himself had killed it because, as she put it, he'd rather run on a problem than fix a problem, turning his attack back on his own record.
But the moment that really seemed to break through that went viral was the bizarre eating the pets rant.
Yeah, that was something else. An astonishing moment where a completely debunked, years-old conspiracy theory made it onto a presidential debate stage.
The claim about Haitians.
Trump repeating this baseless claim that Haitians in Florida were stealing and killing people's pets for food. Just outlandish stuff.
And the sources trace where that might have come from.
Yes, they note that this specific vile lie was strongly associated with the far-right conspiracy theorist Laura Loomer. And observers had apparently seen Loomer traveling with Trump on his plane earlier that same day.
So it highlights the disinformation ecosystem they were up against.
Exactly. It showed they weren't just debating a political opponent. They were fighting against a whole coordinated network pushing fabricated narratives.
One key difference noted in the sources, though, compared to the earlier Biden-Trump debate, was the role of the moderators.
Yes, crucial credit is given here. The moderators in this debate apparently cut in repeatedly, fact-checking Trump's lies in real time.
Which hadn't happened effectively before.
Right. The lack of immediate, forceful fact-checking in the Biden debate was seen as a major failing, allowing misinformation to just hang there, potentially influencing viewers. This time, the debunking was swift and direct.
Beyond the policy lies, Trump also quickly pivoted to racial and identity attacks. Specifically, that comment at the National Association of Black Journalists event, the happened-to-turn-black remark.
Yeah, that was a deeply cynical, calculated attack, designed specifically to paint her as somehow inauthentic, an opportunist who wasn't really black until it became politically convenient.
Saying he thought she was Indian first.
Claiming he didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black. It was clearly intended to provoke a defensive, maybe angry emotional reaction, get her off balance.
And the strategic response was critical here. She refused to engage on his terms.
Precisely. The sources detail her decision not to take Trump's bait, meaning not giving a big, dramatic, defensive speech trying to prove her blackness or her identity.
Why not? What was the internal reasoning?
Her argument, recorded in the sources, was profound. She saw it as Trump's classic tactic. Throw out outrageous, offensive, distracting statements to derail the conversation, to stop people talking about actual issues that matter to their lives.
Make the whole debate about his slur.
Exactly. Her thinking went something like, okay, so today he wants me to prove my race. What's it going to be tomorrow? He'll say, I'm not really a woman, and I'll need to show my vagina on stage. It was about refusing to let him define the terms of the debate.
And she drew on personal history for that resolve.
Yes, she apparently invoked her mother's stern advice. Don't you ever let anyone tell you who you are. You tell them who you are. So she refused to be defined by his slur, refused to let him hijack the campaign's agenda.
Okay, one more key media moment. The CNN town hall. There was a specific instance where she seemed to consciously separate her stance from the previous administration, particularly on Trump's fundamental character.
Yes, Anderson Cooper asked the question that was probably inevitable. Do you think Donald Trump is a fascist? A really loaded question.
And her response?
The decision was made beforehand to answer directly, yes, I do. But critically, the strategy wasn't just to state her opinion. She immediately buttressed it.
Oh.
By citing his own former top officials, naming people like his former chief of staff, General John Kelly, who had used similar stark language to describe Trump's tendencies.
So using his own team against him.
Exactly. The argument became, look, it's not just me. his political opponent saying this. It's the people who worked most closely with him, his own hand-picked generals and advisors. That carries far more weight, makes it much harder to dismiss as just partisan sniping.
And then after the town hall officially ended, there was this interesting moment with the undecided voters.
Yeah, this was apparently unscripted but strategically brilliant. As soon as the broadcast formally signed off, instead of just leaving, she deliberately walked off the main stage and went straight into the audience.
To talk to who?
To talk directly to the undecided Pennsylvania voters who hadn't had a chance to ask their questions during the live show, discussing things like student loan debt relief, reproductive rights, their specific concerns.
And the cameras were still rolling?
Yes. CNN's cameras kept rolling, and the commentators, who were starting their post-show analysis, actually had to stop and cut back to the live feed of her just talking, very naturally, with these voters.
What message did that send?
It sent a powerful visual message. Her priority wasn't just the slick TV performance or the pundit analysis. It was connecting directly with real people about their real issues. Mm. It felt authentic and grounded. Hashtag tag V, the campaign trail, and connecting with voters.
So beyond the debates and town halls, the sources detail this really aggressive effort to connect with voters in different ways, often leaning into cultural relevance, moving beyond just traditional political events. The Atlanta rally seems like a prime example of this shift in strategy.
Absolutely. That Atlanta rally was designed from the ground up specifically for her candidacy. It wasn't just carrying over the style of the previous administration's rallies.
What was the new approach?
The strategy, as the sources describe it, was to lean it up, broaden the cultural appeal, embrace more creativity, more energy, and that meant bringing in real cultural powerhouses.
Like Megan Thee Stallion and Quavo.
Exactly. Securing performers like them was a major statement.
Was there any nervousness about that? Did some worry it might seem too Hollywood or alienate certain voters?
Oh, yes, definitely. The sources mention anxiety among some supporters, that fear of alienating older, maybe more traditional voters.
But the campaign pushed forward.
They did. The argument internally was clear.
Yeah.
We need to welcome everybody, whether you're a Bruce Springsteen fan or a Lil Wayne fan, you're welcome in this coalition. And the performers leaned in, too. Megan Thee Stallion apparently wore these striking blue pantsuits.
A nod to the candidate's style.
A deliberate nod. And Quavo, whose own family has been tragically affected by gun violence, used his platform to talk about activism. It felt authentic.
And did it work? Financially, at least.
The results were immediate and massive. The sources report they raised $47 million online in just the 4 hours immediately following that debate performance and the energy from the rally. A huge injection of cash.
Wow. Beyond the big rallies, though, there was also this focus on establishing a certain tone, emphasizing dignity and the rule of law. That moment when she interrupted the lock him up chant at a Wisconsin rally seems key.
Yes, that was clearly a deliberate, necessary moment of setting boundaries, enforcing political discipline. As the crowd started chanting that during her critique of Trump.
Which happens at rallies.
It does. But she immediately held up her hand, stopped them cold. And she was very clear. She stressed, we don't lock people up because they are our political opponents.
Drawing a line.
A very bright line. She emphasized that people are locked up only if a jury, after due process, determines they've committed serious crimes. As a former prosecutor, she talked about the moral weight of taking away someone's liberty and absolutely refused to weaponize the justice system for political cheering.
The campaign also made a point of reaching out aggressively to diverse communities, right? Like recording a town hall specifically with undecided Latino voters in Las Vegas.
Yes, that was crucial. The conversation there was apparently very intense, very raw. It touched on issues that really cut across demographics. High prices, cost of living worries were huge. But immigration reform was also central.
Any specific story stand out from that?
There was one particularly emotional moment described where a woman talked about her mother dying after living and working in America for years without citizenship, unable to afford the medical care she desperately needed.
Heartbreaking.
It really highlighted the human cost of the political system's failure to pass comprehensive immigration reform over decades. And it provided important context for understanding that slow, steady drift of some segments of the Latino vote away from Democrats since 2016, often driven less by ideology and more by these pressing economic and family survival concerns.
And this need to go where the voters are, not just where politicians usually go, led her to some pretty unconventional platforms, like appearing on the All the Smoke podcast. That's a sports podcast, right?
Yeah, with former NBA players Steven Jackson and Matt Barnes. a very different audience, specifically targeting younger male voters, black men in particular, who might not be tuning in to traditional political shows.
What was the conversation like there?
It allowed for a much more candid, less formal, more personal conversation. They apparently talked about shared experiences, like the complexities of being step-parents. They talked about mutual concerns around childhood trauma, the protective impulse that drives them.
Stephen Jackson, Stack, he has a personal connection to George Floyd, doesn't he?
Yes, they were friends. And Stack apparently made this really critical point during the conversation. The main difference between him, a successful athlete, and his friend George Floyd wasn't talent or potential, it was opportunity. He argued the whole system is fundamentally broken if only the truly exceptional individuals can break through and succeed. It really echoed the campaign's broader focus on systemic barriers and the need for opportunity for everyone.
But this outreach to younger voters, especially young men, leads us to one of the really difficult findings detailed in the sources after the election, the bro vote problem.
Yeah, this post-election study sounds like it was a brutal reality check for the campaign's assumptions about voter motivation. They lost significant ground among voters under 30, and particularly among young men.
And the reason wasn't what they expected.
Not primarily. While the campaign might have assumed issues like reproductive rights or maybe Gaza would be the primary drivers for young voters, the study found something different. 40% of young voters said their top priority was the economy and jobs.
40%. What about abortion or climate change?
Much further down the list for this demographic in the study. Abortion at 13%. Climate change at only 8%. The economy absolutely dominated their concerns.
Okay, so if the economy was the clear top priority for this crucial group, how did the campaign apparently fail to connect its economic message effectively with them? Does this maybe link back to that initial triage choice we discussed, where they sidelined the more complex economic arguments about long-term investment?
It seems highly likely there's a direct link there. The sources suggest the failure is probably twofold. First, they struggled to translate their economic policies, which often involve complex, longer-term investments, into simple, relatable messaging that could effectively counter the persistent, if arguably false, narrative that Trump was some kind of economic savant.
Trump's messaging on the economy is usually pretty simple, often protectionist.
Very simple, very direct. And it cut through, especially with voters feeling economic anxiety. Second, by prioritizing the immediate simplicity of, say, housing costs or drug prices, over a more comprehensive explanation of how the administration's bigger picture plans things like infrastructure investment, boosting clean energy manufacturing, would actually create concrete job opportunities and career paths for young people. Well, they potentially lost the chance to frame the future economy in a way that resonated powerfully with Gen Z's own aspirations and needs. They didn't sell the long game effectively enough to that group. #6, crisis management and systemic failures.
As the campaign headed into its final months, it seemed increasingly defined by crisis management, starting with the horrific Hurricane Helen, which tore through the Southeast in September and October.
Yeah, devastating storm. And while the vice president was dealing with the immense logistical challenge of the federal response, which is, you know, a fundamental constitutional duty of the office, she simultaneously had to fight this relentless wave of disinformation about the response itself.
Trump was spreading lies about it.
Immediately. Propagating these completely unfounded partisan lies, accusations that the administration was intentionally withholding aid from Republican areas, or even diverting FEMA money to undocumented immigrants. Baseless stuff.
But the sources say those lies were actually rebutted by a key Republican figure on the ground.
Yes, Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, a Republican who often clashed with Trump, publicly pushed back almost immediately. He confirmed that the outgoing President Biden had called him directly, asking simply, "What do you need?" No politics involved.
So the facts were clear, but the lies spread anyway.
That's the core problem. Officials on the ground quickly debunked the claims, but the sheer speed and volume of the misinformation, amplified by powerful figures online. The sources mention Elon Musk echoing claims about FEMA funds being misused to import voters. It was just overwhelming.
The sources seem to suggest the misinformation around the hurricane was almost as damaging as the storm itself in terms of undermining trust in institutions.
It really highlighted this dangerous systemic breakdown of basic information guardrails. There's mention of this absolutely wild conspiracy theory that spread widely on social media.
What was it?
The theory, which apparently got over 11 million views, was that elites, were using secret weather modification technology to deliberately steer the hurricane towards Trump-voting counties.
Seriously, weather modification?
Seriously, it just demonstrates the terrifying challenge of trying to govern or even just communicate basic facts in an environment where scientific reality can be instantly discarded by millions in favor of partisan fantasy. It's a profound problem.
Amidst these immediate crises, the campaign also tried to keep focus on deeper structural issues. They dedicated a major announcement on September 15th to the child care crisis, calling it a subject of vital importance.
Yes, this was clearly an issue they saw as transcending typical demographics. It affects everyone, particularly the ability of women, but also men, to fully participate in the economy.
And the sources paint a pretty bleak picture of the childcare system itself.
They describe it as fundamentally broken. It's incredibly labor-intensive work, yet the pay for childcare workers is often poverty level. The providers themselves operate on razor-thin margins, leading to constant instability, closures, childcare deserts.
And this isn't just a social issue. There's a major economic cost.
Huge. The sources cite a specific analysis. If women in the U.S. participated in the labor force at the same rate as men do, the national GDP would be 5% higher. 5%.
That's a massive number.
It is. So the focus on childcare was a deliberate attempt to link economic stability directly to family support. The argument was, fixing childcare isn't some kind of social handout. It's actually a powerful engine for national economic growth and recovery.
And then, inevitably, it seems, the unique American tragedy of gun violence struck again during the campaign with the Appalach High School shooting.
Yeah, another horrific reminder that the leading cause of death for children and adolescents in the United States isn't disease or accidents, it's guns.
The sources mention the candidate's personal experience with this issue as a prosecutor.
Yes, they highlight her firsthand knowledge, having had to view autopsy photos in the past. Knowing the absolutely devastating, irreparable trauma that bullets from semi-automatic rifles inflict, especially on a child's body, it's a visceral understanding that goes beyond statistics.
And the details around the weapon used in that specific shooting are just gut-wrenching.
They really are. The shooter apparently used a semi-automatic AR-15-style weapon. And how did he get it? It was given to him as a Christmas gift.
A gift, despite warning signs.
Despite the fact, according to the sources, that the boy actually had a picture of the Parkland school shooter hanging on his wall. Just a catastrophic failure at multiple levels.
And this happened against a backdrop of legislative frustration.
Deep frustration. Combined with the Supreme Court having recently struck down the federal ban on bump stocks, it made the fight for gun safety legislation feel like this unending, demoralizing game of whack-a-mole. You make progress, it gets rolled back. Her position remained firm, though. Support for assault weapons bans, universal background checks, red flag laws, the standard common sense measures that remain blocked. Hashtag tag 7. The final days, defeat, and duty.
Okay, so we arrive at the final, incredibly intense, and ultimately deeply emotional stages of this 107-day whirlwind. Election day itself, November 5th. How is the mood inside the campaign?
Despite the polls being incredibly tight, nail-bitingly close, the team apparently entered Election Day with a surprising sense of high confidence.
Really? Based on what?
Based on their internal intelligence, their modeling, and particularly reports of very high early turnout in key areas they thought favored them. They even had some external validation. The sources mentioned John Ralston, the widely respected Nevada election analyst, predicting just hours before polls closed that they would likely squeak to victory.
So they were prepared for a celebration.
The candidate was literally prepared to head over to Howard University, where a large crowd was gathered, expecting to celebrate a win. The shock when the reality hit must have been profound.
And that moment of realization, the sources say, came via a phone call from the chief strategist, Joel Dixon.
Yes. Dixon's call was the moment the confidence shattered. Just the blunt professional assessment, I don't think you're going to get there.
How did she react? According to the sources,
the immediate shock was immense, but her very first question wasn't about herself or the campaign. It was, oh my God, what's going to happen to our country? But a profound concern for the nation's future, right in that instant of personal defeat.
And then came the processing.
Then came what the sources describe as the classic stages of grief, kicking in denial, bargaining as her mind just struggled to absorb the sheer magnitude of the loss, what it meant.
The decision was made pretty quickly not to have her personally address the crowd at Howard that night, right?
Yes. That decision was immediate. It was deemed too raw, too difficult. They delegated the painful task of going out to acknowledge the uncertainty, the likely loss, to Cedric Richmond, a senior advisor. The concession speech itself came the following day, November 6th.
Concession speeches are always difficult, but this one had a particular challenge, didn't it? Reconciling the campaign's energy with the outcome.
Exactly. The central task was incredibly complex. How do you square that constant energizing rally chant, "When we fight, we win," with the reality of an electoral defeat?
So what was the message?
She was absolutely determined, the sources say, not to concede the underlying fight that had fueled the whole campaign, even while conceding the election result itself. The focus was entirely on motivation, on keeping people engaged.
The message being?
That the fight for the country, for its ideals, its soul, its future, is always worth it. Even if victory takes longer than you hoped, it was explicitly a call to keep fighting, keep organizing, especially directed at the young people who had poured so much energy into the campaign. Don't give up.
And then, even after the concession, one final, perhaps the most difficult duty of her office remained, presiding over the official certification of Trump's election victory in Congress in January.
Yeah. That moment must have required just every ounce of poise and self-discipline, as the sources put it, upholding the rule of law, the peaceful transfer of power, even when certifying the victory of the opponent who had attacked her so viciously.
The sources emphasize the historical weight of that specific act.
They do, pointing out she became only the third vice president in American history to perform that specific duty, certifying an opponent's win, following Richard Nixon, who had to certify JFK's win over him, and Al Gore, who certified George W. Bush's win over him.
How did it play out?
She waited for the Republican applause in the chamber to die down, read the final electoral vote tally, 312 for Trump, 226 for Harris, declared the result formally, and as the sources soberly conclude, democracy stood, a profoundly difficult but necessary act.
After that final duty, the sources describe an immediate need for a break, a retreat, described as finally reaching for the oxygen mask.
Yes. Taking some time away at a rented house near Mauna Kea just to decompress, process everything. And that period of reflection led to some pretty profound and maybe bleak conclusions about the state of the nation.
What was the core reflection?
The central, painful conclusion detailed in the sources was about systemic failure, a realization that the traditional guardrails of American democracy seemed to be failing at almost every level.
Meaning?
Executive norms, judicial independence, legislative functionality, corporate responsibility, even media integrity. The assessment was that all these institutions designed to protect democracy were buckling under pressure.
And the implication of that?
The really difficult conclusion was that simply working within the existing system, playing by the old rules, might no longer be enough. Because, as the source puts it, every single guardrail that is supposed to protect our democracy is buckling. A very stark assessment.
And that sobering realization then pivots towards the future, towards where hope might lie. The sources talk about Gen Z as the destiny of the country.
Yes, there's a strong focus on Gen Z. Numerically, they're now larger than the baby boomer generation. And look what they've already lived through. A global pandemic, major economic shocks, the accelerating climate crisis, the constant toxicity of social media. They're inheriting a world in turmoil.
So what's the proposed solution or path forward?
The argument presented in the sources is that it requires massive structural investment in that generation, something on the scale of the post-World War II GI Bill.
Investment in what, specifically?
Not just traditional four-year college degrees. The focus needs to be much broader. Adaptable education, skilled trades, the critical skills needed for the clean energy transition, and crucially, skills for adapting to the rapid disruption coming from AI and robotics.
An education system ready for constant change.
Exactly. The goal described is an education and support system supple enough to adapt to rapid change, preparing Gen Z not just for jobs, but for navigating a fundamentally transforming world. Hashtag take outro.
Well, this has been quite a journey through these 107 days, just an immense undertaking covering everything from that initial frantic political triage and complex global diplomacy all the way to fighting unprecedented misinformation and finally fulfilling that incredibly difficult constitutional duty.
It really has. And I think the biggest takeaway for you listening to this deep dive is the stark clarity these sources provide on several things. First, the extreme cost, personal, financial, emotional disservition of running for the highest office today. And second, the profound systemic vulnerabilities that this particular election cycle revealed, especially the unchecked power of coordinated misinformation and the influence of concentrated wealth in politics.
But despite the ultimate outcome, the loss, the source material seems to argue that those 107 days weren't entirely in vain.
No, there's a strong argument presented that it served as a necessary act. an act of reclaiming her own identity against damaging caricatures, pushing back forcefully, and ultimately proving her capability to lead on the biggest stage, even in defeat. A trial by fire.
And that brings us, as always, to our final provocative thought, something for you to mull over. The source material noted something fascinating. Right after the election, one of the top questions people were searching online was simply, what is a tariff?
Yeah, indicating maybe a gap in basic economic understanding, despite the economy being the top issue.
Exactly. And the campaign's conclusion, reflected in the sources, was that the fight for America's future, fixing these deep problems, won't just come out of Washington, D.C.
Right.
It requires that massive, sustained investment in the next generation, in Gen Z, preparing them for this world of intense economic upheaval, the escalating climate crisis, massive technological transformation.
A world they're already navigating.
Right. So the question for you is this. Considering the huge societal changes Gen Z has already endured and the ones barreling towards us, what specific structural investment, whether in education, the economy, social safety nets, what investments are you now convinced are absolutely necessary to stabilize the nation's future and try to prevent these systemic failures, these buckling guardrails from repeating?
Because the sources seem to conclude, the failure of the system is now the central challenge facing that next generation.
We'll leave that deep dive with you.